The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hi, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest hosting today for Desiree Shell. Today I'm here with science writer Scott Hewler. Scott has written about everything from the plight of uprooted hockey teams to the care required in bikini waxing. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and on National Public Radio. His sixth and most recent book is On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. Hi and welcome, Scott. It's a real pleasure to chat with you today.
It's great to be here. I'm so glad you invited me on.
So this is a book of pretty much the most everyday things around us, the things we kind of take for granted, sewage treatment, clean water delivery, power systems. What made you want to write a book like this?
Really, my whole life is probably what made me want to do it. But the thing that pushed me over the edge was in 2007 and 2008, down here in central North Carolina, we had a drought of biblical proportions. I mean, it was insane how little water we had left in our reservoir, and our grass was turning brown and crunching underfoot, and we were having all kinds of water restrictions. And the city council of Raleigh finally said, okay, just don't wash your car, don't water your lawn, don't use water for anything other than things that you absolutely need. And once in a while, you drive around and you'd see someone watering their lawn at the edge of town. And I drove around one day and there was a sign. Somebody was watering their lawn and they had a sign put up and it said, don't complain. This is not city water. It's well water. And I thought, oh, that other water, that water that has nothing to do with the water that recharges our streams and fills our reservoirs and charges the neighbors well. That's your water. Use as much as you want. And I thought, how could you know so little about how your water gets to you? And then I realized, you know, this is the United States of America. You can be in the middle of this unbelievable drought where it hadn't rained for months, and you could turn on the faucet to brush your teeth. And of course, it's America, so you leave the water running while you're brushing your teeth because we have everything is free forever. And so you could start humming Beethoven's Ninth and get into it and hum for 75 minutes. And when you're done brushing your teeth, you may not have any enamel left on your teeth, but there will still be water flowing out of your faucet. And I thought, how does that happen? How can that be that we have so much of this incredible resource available to us? And the next time I take a drink of water and I get some kind of waterborne illness, it'll be the first time, not just for me, but for me and you and everybody we both know in North America. And then you start asking questions and looking at all the other things that you take for granted. I thought about it in terms of waking up in the morning. I wake up and I'm just like you. I whack the snooze bar and I'm back asleep in 1 second. And so before I've opened my eyes, that's already two major systems, the broadcast information, shooting information to me either through cables or through the airwaves, and the electrical system that keeps both the broadcast information and my clock radio working. And my eyes aren't even open yet. And that's these two incredibly complicated systems. Then you get up and you groggily shuffle into the bathroom. Two more systems, fresh water and wastewater. 10 minutes, your day is going, and four hugely complicated systems have already supported you. And I thought, well, okay, from where? Since when? Whose idea was it? How do they do that? How does that work? How does that water get from wherever it comes from to me? And, you know, we joke all the time about our kids who think that food comes from the store, and we're all the same way.
Water just comes out of the tap, right?
Exactly, exactly. The science historian James Burke had a 1978 documentary television series called Connections, and he said about our infrastructure systems, never in history have so many known so little about so much. And I thought that couldn't be more true, and I want to know.
They really surround us every day, and it's incredible how easy it is to just assume there's water because it always comes out of your tap. my reading of the book is that it's not so much sort of the book for somebody who already thinks infrastructure is fascinating, that it's really a way of sort of drawing people in who might not be paying attention. Am I right in thinking about it that way?
I think that's exactly right. I think, in fact, if you look at all of my work, every book I write, every article I write, every radio piece or video I shoot, it's essentially a way of running down the street screaming, wake up, look around you, pay attention to this stuff. This is important. This is vital. You should be paying attention to all of these things that you're completely ignoring. And what you said before was exactly right. It's so easy to ignore because it's so easy to be alive the way we are. And people, you know, if it started before you were 5 years old, then that's how it's been since the dawn of time. If you woke up in 1940 and you were in, I don't know, a Raymond Chandler novel or something, and you were a pro ball player or a Rockette or something, and you were going on the road. If you woke up in Boston and then you went to Cincinnati and Pittsburgh and Detroit and St. Louis, you know, on some circuit, and every place you stayed in a hotel and you got up in the morning and you used the toilet and you flushed it, every one of those places, when you flushed your toilet, everything that you flushed away went directly into a lake or a river or a stream completely untreated. That's 1940. And I had no concept of that because, again, I'm like everybody else. I was born in 1959, and we had plenty of sewage treatment then. So as far as I'm concerned, the founding fathers of the United States of America had, you know, flush toilets. What do I know?
I would have assumed the same thing. That actually surprised me a lot how late some of these innovations were that I always thought was just, of course we treat sewage before we dump it into a lake. Why wouldn't we have been doing that for... Yeah, exactly. Since the founding fathers, or since the Plains of Abraham, we might say here in Canada.
Right. Yes. Since the War of 1812.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you mentioned a bit that this was really inspired by walking around and by what was actually happening in Raleigh. It really is very much a book about your home. You tell us a lot about where everything really starts, from a piece of pipe that centers the survey of your house to the way things look on your street and beyond. Why do you think that Raleigh actually makes a really good case study for something like this?
Well, I think it makes a really good case study for two reasons. One is about Raleigh, and one is about the nature of case studies and infrastructures.
Okay.
The first one is Raleigh. Raleigh is, I think, a perfect example of what's happening in the West, in the Southern United States, and in the United States. In the time period that I was writing about, Raleigh was the fastest growing metropolitan area in the United States, which is that all these people leaving the Rust Belt, leaving the Clevelands and Pittsburghs and Detroits of this world and the New Jerseys and even California that they're getting sick of, where they're going is Raleigh, North Carolina, or places exactly like it, mm-hmm. places that are not so much growing as metastasizing. They are explosively growing, and they're very, very rapidly outgrowing their systems. Raleigh, for example, has almost no public transportation to speak of. And it's heartbreaking because we need it so badly, but yeah. People don't want to pay for it. As you may have noticed, we have lost our minds here regarding taxes. And nobody wants to pay for that. And yet, if you've been places with longer standing infrastructure, you see how vital is that particular piece of infrastructure.
Yeah. And
living in Raleigh, I very quickly learned when I moved to Raleigh, I left from Philadelphia. I had lived in Philadelphia for a decade, and a great editorial writer walked up to my desk at the Philadelphia Daily News when I was moving down here to work at the News and Observer. And he said, well, it's a whole different story down there. All the stories are about zoning. And I looked at him like he was from Venus. What? What are you talking about? And I moved down here, and of course he was exactly right. All the stories are about land use and resource allocation, whereas in Philadelphia, if you wrote a story about infrastructure, it usually started out with, you know, a piece of masonry killed someone today, as you know, because the infrastructure up there was falling apart. The infrastructure down here, we're building, and we're figuring out what to do. If you start in central Raleigh and you drive away from the center to the newer parts of the city, it's like driving back in time, where first you see built houses and then you see you know, subdivisions that aren't quite, or that are just finished and the grass isn't growing. And then you go and you see subdivisions with houses that are half built. And then you go and you see just streets. And then you go back out far enough and you see, you get to these big red scars in the land that they've just dug into the clay and they're felling the trees and they're building house after house after house. And you see trenches where they're laying sewer pipe or where they're putting in water pipes. And you see these little pedestals where the wires are going to come up for the electricity or for the communications. And you realize it's like seeing the bones of the infrastructure sticking out as before they put the flesh on this armature. And it's an amazing thing.
So in a massively growing city, that kind of development and thought about infrastructure is really obvious then, isn't it?
It absolutely is. But even it doesn't have to be in a growing city because the infrastructure is always changing. I remember I stepped out when I lived in Nashville, Tennessee. I stepped out of my door and I saw a guy in a bucket truck and he was up there doing something. And I'm a reporter, so I said, "Well, what are you doing?" And he said, "We're stringing another circuit into the grid." And I kind of went, the grid, there it is, the grid. You know, we talk about it like the grid, this conceptual thing, but there it is. It hangs above our heads. It occupies space. It has weight. It's a real thing. The grid, all these wires that connect to everything. This is a real thing, this grid we talk about. And that was in the early 2000s. And I think that was probably the very beginning of this. I started to do a radio series. I set out to do a radio series on all of these infrastructure systems. I thought, well, okay, I just learned about the grid. I'll do one about electricity and I'll do one about cable and I'll do one about water and one about wastewater. And of course, as a reporter, you're always too busy doing whatever comes up. And so it was a sort of an unmade radio series that became the book on the grid. So that's one of the good reasons to focus on Raleigh or a place like Raleigh. The other reason that I thought it was great to focus on my home was that when we talk about infrastructure, we all think about the Big Dig in Boston, or we think about the Golden Gate Bridge or the Hoover Dam or something, these huge, enormous, very sexy, exciting infrastructure projects. And to my mind, those are like the Sports Illustrated swimsuit models of infrastructure, which is to say they're larger than life. They're very sexy and exciting, but they don't really relate to you in any meaningful way. But if you want to understand what a woman is like, an actual woman, you should go to a grocery store or a parent teachers association meeting. You're going to be a lot more successful. So I thought if you really want to understand infrastructure, what you ought to do is take a thin slice of Whitaker Mill Road, which is the biggest road right near my house. And I thought, well, underneath it, there's sewer lines and water lines. And above it, there's electrical lines and cable lines. And there's road paving, which follows some sort of structural standard that I know nothing about. And a bus runs along it once in a while. And that's infrastructure where we literally live. That's not some big sexy thing that everybody could just say, oh, okay, interesting enough, toss it aside. That's here we are. And finally, one of my favorite reviews of the book was written by a guy who said for the first chapter or two, he was getting frustrated because I was telling him all these things about Raleigh. And he kept saying to himself, well, that's interesting enough, but how does it happen in my town? And he said, suddenly he woke up and he thought, that's exactly what this author wants me to be saying. What about my town? How does it work here? And that's exactly right. I feel like, okay, with that guy, success.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Scott Hewler, author of the book On the Grid, and blogger at Scientific American, where he contributes to the energy-themed blog Plugged In. So you actually described a little bit of the chapters there, that there's, you know, there's a chapter about water treatment, there's a chapter about sewers, and sort of each of them highlights a different one of the city's infrastructure systems. One of the common themes, though, is pretty much every one of them has you out on the street or under the street, as the case may be, actually trying to trace the paths taken by your stormwater and your wastewater and your own electrical services. What inspired you to tackle the story with that really direct physical exploration?
Because I thought it would be fun.
sounded like fun.
Well, that's what I keep telling people, that this book was like having the best sixth grade field trip of your life,
you know. I can see that.
Once a month for a year. It was just, I got to go to the nuclear plant. You know, when I saw the spent fuel rods, it glows blue. It actually does. It's called Cherenkov radiation. You know, I got to splash around in the storm drains beneath my city and wear a miner helmet with a headlamp on it. It was just so much fun to find this stuff out and to go to a water plant, for example, and you know they treat the water. What does that mean? Oh, I don't know. You know, nobody knows. And you realize that you have this vision of like, well, they take a coffee filter or something and, you know, then they pour it through. Well, it's so complicated and they've learned so much in the couple hundred years that they've been doing this. And actually a couple thousand years, if you look back to the very beginnings of it, the Romans were using almonds. The starch in crushed almonds would help what they call flocculate the water. It would help stuff suspended impurities in the water clump together and then fall to the bottom. The Romans, you know, it's amazing how long this stuff has been going on, how long people have been learning things.
I was fascinated by a lot of the sort of historical story that you trace and how much of the ideas that guide the way we do things now have actually been around for a long time.
Yeah, we love to convince ourselves that we're so advanced and we're so smart, but we haven't really thought of anything. You know, the Romans had roads with crowns in them, and all of these wonderful words that we use, you can find these great stories for. For example, the Romans figured out that, you know, if you put a gravel base and then if you raised the road and you put a ditch by the side of the road and you had a crown in the middle so that the rain would run off, everything would go a lot better. Well, then when you would fix it, you would go and you would build it up again. And so the road kept getting further and further above the surrounding territory. That was the important roads the central Roman government maintained. And so even today, when we take the big important roads, what road do we take? The highway. We have running water. We all think, well, we have running water because we want to have nice, sweet, drinkable water and be able to wash our babies' butts and, you know, without any worries. And of course, we don't have it for that reason. We have running water because our houses were catching on fire because we were building these incredibly dangerous cities, everything stuffed on top of each other and cooking with open fires, you know. So people figured out, okay, well, my house catches on fire and then, you know, five blocks over, they wake up the horses and they start pumping water into a wagon and, you know, forget it. The whole thing is over. And I thought, well, wait a minute. If we put water in elevated tanks and then run wooden pipes, you know, either like barrel staves or trees with the centers augered out and then charred with wood, if we just fill them with water, pressurized water, because of the suspended tanks up in the air, well, then if my house gets on fire, all we have to do is auger a hole in the pipe that's running right down the street, and then we've got water, and we can bucket brigade it, or we can just hose it, and we have a fighting chance against the fire. And then when that fire is out, well, are you going to dig up the whole log and replace it? No, you're going to just tap that like bunging a keg, because if there's another fire, it'll just pull out the plug, right? So what do we have now? We have fire plugs.
The simplicity of that whole sort of fire hydrant system coming from, tapping into a hollowed out log like that was really, it was a really great image. Like, I learned a lot just from hearing that little bit. We'll be right back to talk of all things infrastructure with science writer Scott Hewler right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Schell. Today I'm talking to science writer Scott Hewler about his book On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. Scott is a former Piedmont laureate and also the author of Defining the Wind, the story of the Beaufort Scale. So we've just been talking about how exciting it was. You're traipsing around the city, you're in the rain. Did you really follow the stormwater in the pouring rain?
I so did. I can't tell you how much that one chapter changed my life. Like I said, I've planned this book out. It's going to be one chapter per system. So you know, I know, everybody knows. What's chapter one? Water. It's going to be fresh water, because if you can't drink fresh water, you die in a couple days, right? It's over. So that's obviously chapter one. If you look at the book, it's chapter three, because there are two systems before you even get to that, which of course I didn't know. One of the systems is surveying and information systems, which blew my mind. Mm-hmm. But the other system is the system of stormwater, because if you don't keep the water off of you, you know, you're going to sicken and die in a second, and your buildings are going to rot, and your food is going to rot, and you're going to live this pestilential, brief, awful life, and then you're going to die. So the first thing turns out to be you can't even have a city unless you manage the stormwater so that you can have buildings and you can have rain, and every time it rains, you don't end up in a mud pit. So the first job of settling is to find a place either up high or to manage the flow of water when it comes down. And so I was stunned by that. And then as soon as you think about it, you think, well, of course, but you don't think about it. And now Raleigh, very fortunately for my purposes, is a recent enough city to have grown up that we have completely separate wastewater sewage systems and stormwater systems. Most larger cities have what we call combined systems, where the stormwater and the wastewater are going to the same place. And there's pluses and minuses for both. But at the moment, every time you build a system, people are building separate systems now, because you don't want your sewage, your wastewater, household wastewater, to be mixing with your stormwater and ending up in your streams, which is what stormwater can do. Yeah. But I found the little tiny stream that my stormwater flows to, and traced it back to where it starts, basically underneath a shopping center in the western part of my city. And that meant I had to walk upstream, you know, into the tunnels that go under the city, because Raleigh's like every city, where it's like, okay, we founded it up here on this little hill because it's surrounded by little rivulets and there's water nearby and all these good reasons. But then the city starts to get bigger and those little streams and creeks are no longer convenient. So you just build your city on top of them. So they run underneath the city, and being down there and seeing these natural processes try to happen despite this awful environment we've given them was kind of beautiful. There was this one point where I was deep under the city, and it had a beautiful arched brick top to this this culvert that I was under. And at one point, for some reason, either on purpose or accidental, I have no idea, there was a big like waterfall, a big downstep where there was like a dam, and then the water would trickle over the dam and fall down to a much lower space and then continue going on. And at the bottom, it's just like any waterfall, where it had dug a little sort of pool for itself and then it was moving on. Of course, there's nothing living down there because it was underground. But you realized, here's this little creek that's just trying to be a creek underneath the earth. And you're like, you wanted to hold its little head up and pat it. You know, it was such a beautiful thing trying to happen. And every step that you take is an amazing thing. For example, I looked up the history of this creek because I wanted to understand it. And it's the Pigeon House Branch is the name of the creek here. And in 1947, when Raleigh built its first big sort of strip center, its first car-based shopping center, instantly, the next time it rained, all the people right downstream of where they had put a parking lot over the spring that started this creek were furious, because this enormous amount of water was sheeting off of the parking lot and sluicing its way down and digging out these people's backyards. They went nuts. They were like, what have you done to us? And so the city engineers sat around and they said, okay, we're going to solve this problem. We are going to trench this creek, and we are going to stabilize it, and we are going to straighten it out, and then that's going to solve the problem. And they all went home and they slept great that night, because they had solved a big problem. Now, of course, we are realizing that all of those decisions were terrible decisions. People are now resolving stream problems by putting meanders back in them and softening the banks so that the stream can come out of its banks like it's supposed to do every year or two. And we're doing everything we can so that they don't dig these awful trenches that we've taught them to dig. And so we realize that we've made these mistakes. And people, when I do readings, I always want to say, so what were those dopes thinking? And I say, no, they were not dopes. They were us. They were solving the problems as they understood them. We can't be mad at them 60 or 70 years ago for not knowing what we know now. They had no concept that straightening out a creek was going to cause, you know, 50 years worth of new problems. So they did what they thought made sense. They did their best. And now we have to fix it. But we have to do our best, too.
And so that decision to walk out that day and follow the stormwater really showed you a lot more than just where it was going at that moment, didn't it?
Exactly. Where it was going and where the creek came from. And you walk down, you continue walking, and you realize these creeks are incredible resources. Even a ruined little creek like the Pigeon House, which is, it's definitely the sickest creek in Raleigh. It might be the sickest creek in North Carolina. But even something like that, it's beautiful, and you see herons, and you see fish, and you see all kinds of wildlife. Even as you walk down and see these awful trenched areas where so much stormwater shoots out like a fire hose from buried pipes whenever it rains that it's destroying the ecosystem. And so you're just standing there and looking at construction debris and, you know, an old newspaper box and an old shopping cart down there and thinking like, oh, what a wreck. And then, you know, what you think is a funny looking bush moves its head and you realize you're looking at a great blue heron and you're like,
yeah, it's still a stream. Even after all that's been done to it, it's still a stream. You mentioned the people who's were initially planning and trying to figure out how to solve these problems. And we see them again in each of your chapters, that the engineers are really they're a lot of the characters of the book. They're the people that you go to talk to and the people that kind of drive your story along. Can you tell me a little bit about how your opinion or your thoughts about engineers changed as you researched it?
I tell people that this book is a love letter to two things that don't normally receive love letters. One of them is taxes, and the other one is engineers. And if I'm doing that at a public reading, I always say, and for the engineers in the audience, love is a human emotion expressed between two different human people. Gets a big laugh. Everybody likes that joke. It's my engineer joke.
You know I trained as an engineer, right?
I do know. But when I was working on this, a very good friend said, I was telling him as I was sort of like really allowing this schoolgirl crush on engineers to really blossom into the deep-seated feelings of true platonic love that they deserve, he said, you're right. Engineers deal with the things that the rest of us don't have to. You know, water and other less appealing substances really do flow downhill. And if you don't make sure that downhill is downhill, you've got a very unpleasant situation. A sewer has to go down 2 feet for 100 feet, you know, has to descend 2 feet for every 100 feet of horizontal run. And if it doesn't, you have big trouble, because it has to be moving fast enough that the solids don't settle out, but slow enough that the liquids don't just leave the solids behind. And people have figured this stuff out. And if you get it off by a couple inches, you're going to have big trouble. The wrong tilt is the difference between a basement and a swimming pool. And everybody's lived through that situation, and nobody likes it. And so the engineers, we trust them, we lean on them. And as so many people told me so many different days, they're working Christmas. They're missing their kid's birthday party. They're missing their kid's basketball game. They are missing their anniversary, because somebody's got to be out there 24/7. You can't just say, okay, we'll let the water plant run itself. Let's go home. Because what if a thunderstorm kicks up? Well, who knew that if it turns out to be a thunderstorm, people use less water? Did you know it?
I didn't know that.
But the engineers do it. It's just some weird quirk of humanity that when it's raining outside, we don't like to turn on the faucet. I can't explain it, but it's something that everybody working in a water plant knows. So that means if there's a thunderstorm coming in, according to the weather report, we're going to get a thunderstorm in 6 hours. That means what I need to do is let a couple of the different water towers, what you and I would call water towers, what they would call elevated storage, we need to let those drain a little bit, because during the period of the thunderstorm, people are going to stop using water and they're going to stop draining the water towers. But we need to keep the plant running, because we can't turn off the plant, because that's a huge problem, and the plant is designed to run at least a base level. And so the water plant needs to keep processing water, and it needs someplace to put that water, which is the elevated tanks. And so we need to leave space in the elevated tanks for between 8 this evening and 2 in the morning when the thunderstorms are running through and nobody's going to be using their water. This is the kind of stuff they need to think about all day long. And it's not just water. Everybody knows about the supposed Super Bowl flush, which turns out to be mostly mythological, although there was a famous graph a couple of years ago when Canada was winning, I think, the Olympic gold medal. Didn't Canada just win that? There was an enormous drop in the water pressure between the second and third period. There's a great graph. Go looking for it. It's wonderful.
I've got to go check that out.
But it really exists. But it's not just that. For example, they talk about managing cable traffic. You have to expect that there's going to be much more cable traffic between 4 in the afternoon and 8 in the afternoon because the kids are home. They're online, you know, playing war games. And, you know, mom's looking up a recipe in the kitchen if we're going to engage in sexist stereotypes, as one of the guys was telling me at the at one of the head-ins. He's like, and dad's online downloading porn. And, you know, but everybody.
No one gets off easy in this scenario.
Right, exactly. Right. Nobody does. But the fact is everybody's online. And
we're all in the grid.
And so there's so much more traffic then, so they need to manage that. And they're thinking about that. And it's the same thing with electricity. And it's the same thing with traffic. And it's the same thing with every one of these systems. And if you don't mind, I want to pick up on something that you just said. We're all on the grid. Can I engage in one piece of fierce diatribe?
Please do.
One of the questions I'm constantly asked is, well, what do you think about people who go off the grid? And I engage in derisive laughter because everybody knows that guy who tells you he's off the grid, right? Because he downloaded plans for his A-frame on the internet and then he drove to the Home Depot warehouse and bought grid-produced lumber, drove there in his grid-produced truck on his grid-paved highway, and used his grid-produced tools to buy all this lumber and go out into his 4 acres up by the National Forest, and he builds his A-frame, and he digs a hole for his septic system, which he bought online and is produced by the grid, and then he builds a satellite dish that gets its internet service like a baby bird with its mouth wide open from a geostationary satellite that's supported by the grid. And then he puts up a windmill to generate his own electricity. And he stands around and he says, look at me, I'm off the grid. And I want to say, when you grow your own flax and weave your own shirts and make buttons, mind you, out of broken oyster shells, and you don't take 100 grid-produced sandpaper to soften the edges, then we can talk about off the grid. But until then, you're as much on the grid as Barack Obama is. That's reality. If you live in the West, you can't be off the grid. It's not possible to be off the grid.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest is science writer Scott Hewler, author of On the Grid and contributor to the Scientific American energy blog Plugged In. We were just talking about the idea of being off the grid or on the grid. And one of the themes that I think really runs through the book and becomes very explicit at the end is that we aren't separate from the grid. We aren't separate from our infrastructure. I think you even go as far as to say that it is us. We are the infrastructure. What really drove that message home for you?
What drove that message home for me is, I think I was mentioning earlier in our discussion, that here in Raleigh we desperately need public transportation, but people absolutely refuse to pay for it. And they'll say all the time, why should I subsidize your train trip or your trip on the bus or whatever, your trolley trip? And if you say to them, why should I subsidize your trip on the new highway we just built north of the city that I don't ever ride on, they look at you like you're insane. It doesn't cross their mind that we build highways. They think the highways grow free like the dandelions, but that to build public transportation, suddenly you're going in their pocket and asking them for money. You don't need me to tell you that people in the United States have gone absolutely mad and believe that you can have services and not pay taxes. And it doesn't make a difference what you want the taxes for. Down here, it's torches and pitchforks. You say taxes and people are ready to throw you in the river. You know, the clean river, the river that you could, that is safe for you to go into because of modern sewage treatment. But that's something that has been driving me absolutely insane, is that there are a billion plus people in the world who would probably cut off a limb to have access to the things that we don't want to pay for their children, right? If you don't have safe water to drink and sanitary sewage treatment, nothing in the rest of your life has much meaning for you. Until you can provide for yourself and your family safe water to drink and a safe way to get rid of your waste, everything else is just, you know, is fantasy. And we don't want to pay for this. People have no understanding of how it works. For example, we were talking about that drought in Raleigh. Well, they did a very good job eventually of explaining to people that they should not waste water. And so people started using less water. Well, guess what? Here's a secret. The water system, the water and sewage system, are an actual revenue center in city government, in almost all city governments, which is to say they pay for themselves, right? Because you're not taxed for water and sewage. You pay that, a monthly fee, right? Or a bi-monthly fee, right? However it is, you get a bill from your city. Well, you pay by how much you use. So what happens if everybody gets better and smarter and uses less? What happens? They're getting less money. They still have to maintain the same number of pipes, and they still have to treat the water, and they still have to treat the sewage. So they have to raise the prices. And so people went nuts here. We did what you wanted. We're using less water. And now you raise the prices? What's that? And I keep wanting to say, anybody here ever take economics? All of these born-again capitalists that believe the market will solve all of life's problems. Did you ever take an economics class? Did we just determine that water is a scarce resource or a plentiful resource? Well, it's scarce. Okay. And scarce resources become more or less expensive. And then people tell you to shut up. But the fact is that all of these things, we don't pay anywhere nearly enough for them, whether it's the ridiculously low gas tax that we pay, whether it is the ridiculously low amount that we pay for water and sewage. Every single person that I spoke with in water treatment, and that's something of an exaggeration, but I would be willing to stand on 70% or more of the people that I interviewed for that section of the book said, unbidden, this is too cheap. People do not understand how little we pay for this vital resource, and they're only going to treat it like it's valuable if we make it expensive. Because think about that. We're not allowed to walk around without a bottle of water in our hands anymore, right? There's some sort of law that was passed that if you don't have a bottle of water that you spend $1.99 for at a convenience store, then you're like an infant. You're going to cry because you don't have a bottle. But that $1.99 that you spent for that quart of water, if you spent the same $1.99 for the water that comes out of your tap, do you know how much water you could get? You could get about 600 gallons of water.
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah, so, that is quite a comparison.
Right. If people don't feel stupid enough for buying all that, like, if yet another reason why bottled water, why we should just be, you know, crucified for bottled water as a concept, you know, to say nothing of the bottles filling up our landfills and all that kind of stuff. But it's just, we have no concept of the value of these resources and of the systems that make our lives not just easy, but make our lives possible. Because if the electrical grid goes down, how fast is it over for us, you know, in Europe and North America? How fast are we done if the electrical grid stops working? Or if the internet goes, explain to me how you're going to go to buy milk if it won't take your card. And you say, oh, that's no problem. Okay, if the internet's down, I'll just go to get to the ATM. Well, guess what? The internet's down. So you can't go to the ATM. The ATM doesn't know who you are and tells you to come back. Well, then we're all walking around with empty wallets and hollow-eyed stares, holding our coffee cups out to each other, hoping that somebody will pour some coffee in them.
The systems work so well. It's really easy to forget what would happen if they weren't there.
Exactly. And I think it's fine. I'm totally in favor of that. I'm totally in favor of technology, but I'm also totally in favor of, we need lots of engineers. We need lots of smart people to take care of these. And you get those people by paying for them. And we also need to know a little bit more about the systems so that we can sensibly take part in the conversations about how to maintain these systems, how to improve them, what they mean. You know, the American Society of Civil Engineers comes out with a report card every few years for the United States' internet. Guess what? D minus every time, because we don't maintain it. We defer, we defer, we defer, we kick it down the road. We are about 2.5 trillion dollars in arrears on maintenance of this infrastructure that we should have been paying over the last 50 years or so. Well, we always seem to find $2.5 trillion or so when it turns out that we want to go to Asia and blow a bunch of people up over there, but we can never find it when it means let's make sure that we could keep our sewer systems running.
Well, thanks for writing this to make us pay a lot more attention. And thanks a lot for being here, Scott. It was a real pleasure to talk to you today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've included links to Scott's book and blog on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Next up, I'll be chatting with Tim DeShant about his infrastructure-themed blog, Per Square Mile. I'll see you after the break.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're giving you the chance to ask a pharmacist. Scott Gavura is an Ontario pharmacist and the editor of the website Science-Based Pharmacy. He'll be here for the whole hour answering your questions. Call our listener question line at 773-257-3101, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com, post a comment on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, tweet us at Skeptical Radio, or leave a comment on our Facebook or Google Plus feeds. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your guest host, Marie-Claire Shanahan. I'm here with science writer Tim DeShant, who writes and produces the population density blog Per Square Mile. Tim is a former mass media fellow at the Chicago Tribune, and before turning to writing professionally, he completed a PhD in environmental science, studying the impact of urbanization on California's oak trees at University of California, Berkeley. Hi, Tim. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks, Mary Claire. It's great to be here.
So tell me a little bit about Per Square Mile. Why write a blog about density?
I really started Per Square Mile kind of as a personal exercise in a way. I'd lived in a number of different cities in the previous decade, and many of them had different population densities. And so one of the things I kind of noticed was that population density could kind of give you a window into what that city or community was like. And I kind of habitually noticed myself looking up population density figures for the different locales in which I was living and those where I was considering moving. So the idea kind of came to me to work through these ideas of population density and how it relates to the human experience within cities, and then how that also affects the natural environment in and around cities. And so that's where Per Square Mile came from. It's obviously kind of an American perspective with the imperial system there, but
true.
It's something that started as a way for me to go through the literature somewhat systematically to really try to understand density in all of its different forms, whether it's population density for humans or something as different as tree densities in forests.
I think we'll hear it as per kilometer, per square kilometer for you. You recently wrote about the connections between city wealth and forest coverage in U.S. cities. Tell me a little bit about that study.
I stumbled across it in one of my usual literature searches. And in that one, it really caught my attention because a lot of times if you're riding your bike or running through a nicer part of town, you'll often notice that it maybe tends to be cooler, a little bit better shaded, a little more green. And so the result they had was fairly intuitive, that when they mapped tree cover and correlated it with income variables for different parts of cities, they found a fairly tight correlation. And in fact, they found that demand for trees increased more as income increased. So I wrote this post up, and then I kind of thought to myself, well, it would be interesting if maybe you could spot these trends from the air. And so I took to trusty Google Maps and checked that out. I've spent a lot of time in the past decade or so looking at aerial photographs, and so it's something that really speaks to me. And in this case, I think it's also something that speaks to other people as well.
Yeah, you've gotten a really good response to that, haven't you?
I have, definitely. And I think in part that's because people can really identify with what they see in Google Maps, and also they can identify with where they live. So they can take a look at where they live and compare it to a neighborhood they know about, whether it's one that's wealthier or poorer than their own, and compare what they see and really kind of get a sense for how that dynamic plays out in their own community.
What were some of the differences that really stood out to you in the cities that you looked at?
For the cities I looked at, the differences really did follow what was found in that initial study. So if you go to areas where income is higher, than another area, you definitely see more tree cover. And that's in part because people have more money to keep up their trees, but they also tend to have more space to plant those trees. Obviously, there's always going to be outliers. Somewhere like Manhattan isn't going to have nearly as many trees as Brooklyn. And even though Brooklyn is still relatively – parts of Brooklyn are still relatively well off compared to Manhattan, that's going to be different. And then another thing that people raised and that I noticed as well is that there are some areas that are still well-to-do but may have less trees than other areas. But it's important to keep in mind that this relationship here, it's not just simply that a place has to be rich and another place has to be poor, although that has a lot to do with it. It really does scale with income. So a place that's wealthy could be superseded by a place that's even more wealthy. So when I looked, for example, in my area, in and around Boston, Massachusetts, I noticed in West Cambridge they have very large lots and the incomes are very high. There's quite a few mansions out there, and they have far more tree cover than the Ball Square neighborhood of Somerville, which is only a few kilometers away. Even though Ball Square is still a relatively well-to-do area in the overall Boston metro area.
So in the study that you wrote about originally, you're talking about the idea that it scaled with income. And you also pointed out that they made some comparisons to how luxury goods scale. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So that's kind of an economic term I'm learning, is that a luxury good is something that scales, I believe, beyond 1% or 2%. So in this case, for every 1% increase in per capita income that they measured, demand for forest increased by 1.76%. So it's not a linear scaling. It's above a one-to-one relationship. And in that sense, it's more similar to what they say is a demand for luxury goods. So trees measured in an economic sense and demand for trees within cities is not considered a necessity, like we might say food or water. Which I think is the part that maybe disturbed me the most, because I think there are a lot of aspects to trees within cities that I believe should make them necessities.
You've actually pointed out some of the disparities that probably come along with having, you know, sort of differential placement of trees, including things like differences in pollution, shading, possibly contributing to asthma rates, and even, I think you cited a study saying it influenced crime as well.
Yeah, that's right. The fighting crime one has been contentious over the years, but I did see a recent study that kind of separated things out. Traditionally, when they look at crime and vegetation, they kind of lump it all together and say vegetation in general. And there have been studies where people have said, oh, it decreases crime. And then there's other studies where they say it increases crime because, for example, the criminals can hide in the bushes. There was another more recent study that I found that actually kind of separated the two out and said, let's look at the understory and then let's look at the overstory and consider them separately. And what they discovered is when you have that thick underbrush that kind of provides cover, they do find increases in crime. But when you have things like tree cover, a nice overstory with a fairly clear understory, you get those kind of, I guess, calming effects and you see a decrease in crime.
So it's a distribution of the vegetation that matters.
That's exactly right. And I think if you kind of compare it to what you might see in the wild, for example, humans would feel very safe. And there have been studies that have shown this as well. People feel more comfortable in kind of open park-like settings with trees in the overstory, but a relatively clear understory that they can see through. But once you start loading that up with shrubs and tall grasses, people start to feel a little bit less comfortable.
So it's probably really difficult to do sort of any kind of like causal study with this. You can't really go through neighborhoods and change them, take away all the trees, or move different people there and see what happens to the trees. In the types of studies that you look at, how can you really start to get at what's really going on?
That is a bit tricky. I think one of the things that, you know, scientists do, like I did in my dissertation, is we look for opportunities for natural experiments where things have been changed on their own and we can maybe go back in time and start peeling back some of those layers and see how changes that have occurred in the past might compare to areas that haven't changed, for example. I know one of my commenters mentioned that Sacramento, California might be a good city to look at for tree cover and income inequality because they have a very aggressive tree planting program to reduce the summer cooling bills And that's available to everyone in the city. So that's something I want to look into. And if no one's done a study on that, perhaps I'll suggest that to the authors of the original study.
Cool. That actually sounds like a really interesting opportunity.
I think so.
I have massive trees in my front yard, and it just means I have trouble getting grass to grow.
Exactly.
I'm sure it keeps my house cool, too.
It definitely does, yeah.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. Today I'm talking to science writer Tim DeShant, author of the density-themed blog Per Square Mile. Tim has also written for Scientific American, Ars Technica, and Grist.org. So we've been talking about trees. We usually kind of think of suburbs and leveling all the trees to put the suburbs in, and maybe think about expanding cities as being a net negative for trees. But you've written a little bit about how it might be the opposite.
So yes, in some cases, cities have been shown to be better for trees than the surrounding landscape had been in the past. So one good example would be, say, Minneapolis, Minnesota, or Madison, Wisconsin. A lot of those areas around there were frequently burned in the past, or so they were prairies, or they were converted into farmland. And obviously farmland doesn't have a lot of trees except for fence rows and a few woodlots. And so a historical study went back and dug through old records and old aerial photos and found that tree cover, in fact, did increase in some cities from 1850, for example, to the present. So what they saw is that even though there was a loss of the traditional land use around those cities, in many cases grazing or farmland, the change from that land use to the urban land use actually increased tree cover in the area.
It is a little bit different than you would expect. You really do sort of think that we're ripping out the trees, but...
Yeah, well, I think, too, that in the short term, we do tend to rip trees out. Developers obviously like to have freedom to move around a lot or a site when they're building. But over time, you know, people really do like trees, and, you know, big established trees within cities are definitely an amenity, and they do raise property values. And so I think people like to put them in, and they like to have them there. So as cities get older, too, I think you'll probably see a trend where forest cover increases if there's space available.
I've kind of been grilling you about trees a little bit. But I grew up on a maple syrup farm. Trees are kind of important. They've always seemed important to me.
Yes, definitely.
So that's the stuff that caught my eye. But writing about density in general actually kind of has to present an interesting challenge in that the issues really are important, and we almost all of us deal with them every day, issues of infrastructure and density and transportation. But I kind of suspect it's not on a lot of people's leisure reading list. How do you decide what to write about and how to write about it in a compelling way?
Yeah, one of the things I try to do is I try to not really restrict myself. So as you said, density is something that affects us all in many different ways. And I think that's a really important point. And I guess I saw an opening for this blog because this is a broad topic that really doesn't get a lot of coherent attention. It pops up here and it pops up there, but there's really no site where you can go and look for it all. And so that's kind of what I try to do. Obviously, I tend to focus on things where I have experience or interest or the background. And so that does tend to be cities and the environment and stuff like that. But I do like to kind of branch out and kind of show examples of where density manifests itself in different ways. So one of them that I did was reading Chinese versus English, for example. I had just returned from my first trip to Taiwan, and I really had kind of gotten thinking about how much information was being conveyed on the signs. You know, they could post a few characters and seem to convey a whole lot of information that might take more English letters, more of the Roman alphabet to say the same thing. So as I looked into it a bit more, I found some studies that showed that, yes, in fact, the Chinese written language is denser, but it actually takes them longer to kind of dive into the character and read it. So they read at a slower pace. English reads faster as a language on average. But, of course, you have to use more space to say that same amount of information. And so I kind of found through diving into issues of language density that we kind of discovered, I guess, maybe a fundamental bottleneck of human cognition, where we can really only understand written language at a certain rate.
There's sort of a constant density in however that density is sort of played out, whether it's
I guess
at the input level or at the character level.
Right, right. And I think it's the way that our brains maybe process language visually that might be that limiting factor. There was another study that came out a few months before I wrote this talking about how some languages sound faster than others, for example. A lot of people remark about how Spanish sounds a lot faster. Well, it turns out that in Spanish, they're saying approximately the same thing in the same amount of time as people in English or Chinese or whatever language. It's just that they use more syllables to say that same thing. So it sounds faster, but they're getting the same point across in the same amount of time. So I think these kind of two things together, again, show maybe some limits of the human brain in terms of interpreting information.
One of my favorite phrases that you use, the first time I encountered it was you were talking about, I think, a very oddly shaped hotel, but you used the term ghosts of geography. It's a really evocative term. And where did it come from?
It's something that came out of my experience in San Francisco. And the term itself just kind of came about as these things do. And yes, I was talking about this Triangle Hotel in San Francisco. And there were actually a number of these ghosts that I had noticed in San Francisco over the years. And this was really the time when Google Maps was kind of first becoming popular. And I was really becoming immersed in just the science and the hobby, I guess, of interpreting and studying aerial photographs. And so what I'd do is I'd be looking through my neighborhood in San Francisco, and you know, whether I was walking home from the train or something else, and I'd notice kind of these oddities, a parking lot where it seems like a parking lot shouldn't be, or a gap between buildings that runs at an odd angle. And as soon as I'd get home, I'd log onto my computer and kind of scour for these patterns, these ghosts that were still lurking in the landscape. And that triangle building was really just the first of many. And over the years, I've kind of kept my eye out for them, and I see them all over the place. Train tracks tend to leave them quite frequently, as do old freeways and on-ramps.
Yeah, it's a really neat way of thinking of them. They leave their impression even though they're not there.
Yeah, exactly. And you can see it in trees, too. We're kind of, again, getting back to trees, where they may have lined a road in the past or a train track again, and then that structure is gone, but the trees remain.
If there's one thing you think we're not paying enough attention to, whether it's these ghosts or whether it's sort of issues of where things are going in the future, what would you say that is? What should cities, both governments and citizens, be really paying more attention to?
I think the biggest thing is how we're creating new ecosystems all the time within cities. And these urban ecosystems are really understudied, but there's really a lot of possibility there too for how we can take the city around us and turn it into some beneficial zone where it's providing habitat for animals, for example, or even beneficial ecosystem services for people. And I think that urban ecology is one place where we could all of us, cities, governments, individuals, we could all really be thinking more about what we can do to foster the ecosystems that are already around us.
What would be the benefit of that, do you think? What can we learn from that?
Number one, we can learn about the resilience of different ecosystems. Obviously, there are few things that are more human impacted than cities, and yet you know, nature always finds a way to survive. And so in understanding that, I think we could better understand how ecosystems anywhere will be affected by human impacts in the future, whether that be climate change or increased intensity in farming or, again, the spread of cities and suburbs around the world. And then also I think we need to focus on how to make cities more benign places environmentally. I think there's kind of a trend out there right now that cities by themselves, without us doing anything additional, are environmentally beneficial because they concentrate our use on the land and they tend to be more energy efficient and so on. But I think there's a lot that we can do to blend them into the landscape better or to, again, like I said, encourage and foster the ecosystems that are in there to thrive and kind of build up their own diversity and resilience.
These really are important issues. Thanks so much for coming to talk to us today.
Well, thanks, Mary Claire. It's great to be here.
You'll find links to Tim DeShant and his blog Per Square Mile on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, so you can keep up with the show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to our program or listen to past episodes. See you next time on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.